Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I'm so glad you're with me today, and I'm very glad to have my guest today. Leslie Karst is just the most fascinating woman. She's the daughter of a law professor and a potter, and she's a cook, and she's lived all in a whole bunch of different places. It's really cool. But right now, I'm doing a special shout-out to my friends in California. Leslie is evacuating her mom from an assisted living facility that's 3 miles away from the fires out there. So everyone be safe. But it's my pleasure to welcome my friend, author Leslie Karst, to the show. Hi, Les. How are you? Are you
coughing away?
Are you hacking away
here
out there? Yeah.
It's not too bad. It's actually my mother-in-law.
Right.
My mom is fine and safe in Santa Cruz, but this is my mother-in-law, and she's 94,
okay,
and she's taking it all very well. She's cracking up and cracking jokes. She's going to be fine. But yes,
But what a horrible thing, you know, to have your life uprooted, and when you're 94, I'm sure she wants to just settle down and relax and not have to go anyplace. But thank goodness that you're there for her and can get her moved out and into safety. But
yes,
let's talk about you and having all these different places that you've lived. Why did you travel so much?
I traveled as a youngster because my father was a law professor at UCLA, and whenever he had a sabbatical, he took us gallivanting all over the world. So when I was 6, we spent a year in Latin America. When I was 16, we lived for a year in Oxford, England. We spent 2 different summers in Mexico. And since then, I got the travel bug and have just traveled on my own because you grow up traveling and you kind of can't let it go.
That's true. It was when it's in your blood like that. Now,
yeah,
are
yeah.
you fluent in Spanish after all the time you spent in Hispanic countries, in Latino countries?
I minored in Spanish lit in college, so I used to be quite fluent. I'm out of practice a little bit now, but I'm trying to get it back. I'm actually much more fluent in French these days because I go to France a lot, and my sister is just retired from being a French professor. And
wow.
I speak some Italian too, which I get to use in my books.
How fun!
Very helpful.
So you just have a knack for language then, because I lived in Miami all my life, and I learned every cuss word there is in Spanish. But you know that, or we speak Spanglish down here. You know, in South Florida, we speak Spanglish. So it's an interesting thing, but. But I can appreciate anyone who has the ear and the knack for language.
If you learn it as a youngster, your brain,
yes.
you know, your kids' brains, the way they evolve. And I was exposed to Spanish at age 6 for a whole year, and I truly believe
sure.
that affected my ability to learn languages in my later life.
Oh, I'm sure it does. I'm sure it
yeah.
does. Yeah, you're attuned to it. So, but what I want to talk about though is the book and the Italian, because not only are you a writer and you're fluent in all these different languages, but you're also a foodie in real life. Witnessed by the fact that you had this wicked grin and a huge knife that you were chopping veggies with that I used on the promo. And I thought, man, I better not tick her off because she's got a knife and knows where I live. So tell me how you decided to start writing cozy mysteries, because they're so much fun. They remind me of Joanna Fluke and you know, all these other really great cozy mystery writers that involve food. I just love it. Let's talk about how you decided to write.
Well, I was a lawyer for 20 years, a research and appellate attorney. So I did writing. That's all I did every day was research and write briefs. And when I retired, it's going on now 10 years ago, I was lucky enough to get to retire relatively young. I knew I wanted to keep writing. While I was working as an attorney, actually, I went back to school and I got my associate's degree in culinary arts from the local community college because I'd always loved food. And after that, I just was, you know, I would throw the, I used, I didn't ever work for pay and as a cook, but I, you know, loved to throw, and still do, throw fabulous dinner parties for my friends. And so when it came time,
how
I thought, you know, I'm going to write something that's more fun than some darn legal brief. What should I write? And I'd always loved mysteries growing up, and I thought, I'm going to write a foodie mystery. So that's where the idea came, because I thought, you know, I could use my legal stuff because of my gal, Sally Solari, is an ex-lawyer like myself. And I was able to use my knowledge of cooking, and I set it here in Santa Cruz because it's such a beautiful, wonderful spot, and I know it very well. And I just kind of wanted to brag to the world about how fabulous Santa Cruz is. But the way I came up with the plot for the first book, which is called Dying for a Taste, is that Santa Cruz, when I first moved there in the 70s, was still sort of a sleepy town. It was retirees and an old Italian fisherman, and then they built a campus in the University of California there in the mid-60s. And by the time I moved there in the early 70s, it was starting to change. The university obviously changes the dynamic of a town. And by the 90s, the foodie revolution had hit Santa Cruz, as you can imagine.
Of course.
You know, we, of course, have Alice Waters and Chez Panisse just up
Alice
the road.
Alice Waters, I was going to say, yeah.
And that whole, movement has really affected my town. But yet at the same time, there's still this other old contingency of these old school Italians that have these, you know, seafood in Italian restaurants. And I thought, you know, it's nice to have sort of a kind of an undercurrent of conflict when you write a book. And I thought, what a perfect conflict between the sort of the old and the new food thing. And so that sort of was the inspiration for the first book, because Sally, who's about 40, is caught right in the middle of it, because she's grown up in this one culture, yet she's around these people who love food and the trendy restaurants and stuff. And so her aunt, who's sort of the black sheep of the family, actually owns one of these trendy restaurants. So right there's this dynamic between her and, you know, in the family. So I thought that'd be fun.
It's so funny because, you know, I always listen to what some of these really, you know, top shelf authors always say, oh, you write what you know, write what you know. But you really have. You have so written exactly what you know. And I just have to say that when I want to tell listeners, when we were in the green room before the show, and I try to tell everyone, you know, what to expect on the show. It's very organic and all. And I said, it's not like studying for the LSAT. And I didn't mean that the way it came out, because most of my authors are not attorneys, but then I forgot that you were. And so, you know, you had to study for the LSAT. So it wasn't hard questions is what I wanted to tell you. I didn't want to be my brother's an attorney and I love him dearly. So, you know, but he's still doing it. He hasn't written his book yet. So I'm going to encourage him though.
I think all attorneys at least think they have a book in them.
I think they do too, and I think for exactly the reason you said, they're used to writing legal briefs, and you know it gets boring and all that. So I think that's true. Now, something else I find interesting about you is you also are part of your local chorus. You sing alto. What kind of music do you sing in your chorus?
The chorus what I've been doing lately is Santa Cruz. I sing with the Cabrillo Chorus, which is it's the community college where I took my cooking classes, actually. And in the springtime, they do a concert every year with the Santa Cruz Symphony. And so my favorite things that I sing with them are the big masterworks. For instance, this coming spring, we're going to be performing the Mahler Second Symphony that has the last movement has a choral part in it. And, you know, we've done the Mozart Requiem, which, of course, my second book is about, which is one of my all-time favorite pieces. And so things like that. We've done the Berlioz Requiem. And Mendelssohn's Elijah and the Beethoven Ninth. And, you know, you just can't imagine how inspiring it is to stand up there with 100 voices around you and a full symphony orchestra.
I had tickets to the opera and the symphony in Miami, so I can, uh-huh. And I love it, it's so magnificent, but how lucky you are to have the voice for it. Even though I took music lessons very young until not too long ago, I can't sing to save my life. If I had to sing for my supper, I would starve. Literally can't hold a tune. I can hear a note be on a glass when you clink a spoon against a crystal glass. I can tell you what note it is, but can play keyboards like they're going out of style. Just have no voice whatsoever. To my utter dismay, I wish
I
could sing.
Has a
I would give
instrument.
Her. You know, I'm not born with it. It's definitely learned. So, you know, I'm not even that great, but I'm so jealous of anyone who can sing. Good for you. Now, you also have a Jack Russell named Ziggy. So I love that. And you go between Santa Cruz and you also go to Hawaii occasionally, don't you?
Yes. So I retired about 10 years ago. And once that happened, and my wife, Robin, and I started splitting our time between Santa Cruz because she's retired too. And so we have the ability to do that. And when you're writing, you can do it anywhere, of course. So actually, I'm leaving this weekend to go back to Hilo for the winter, which is, of course, adding to the excitement of the fire and dealing with Robin's mom. But it's all good.
Wow.
Yes, Hawaii. Live half time in Hilo, Hawaii, and it's absolutely wonderful. It's beautiful.
Oh, fabulous! So you've lived in all these exotic locations. Are you able to pull from all these cultures when you're writing and insert them into your books?
I think I kind of am. You know, in the first two books, which are out already, I've used a certain. Sally's sort of second in command at her restaurant is a fellow named Javier who grew up in Mexico, and having spent a lot of time in Mexico, I feel like I can do justice to that character. And then there's a gal in the second book who's a choral director named Marta, and she's from Napoli, and I have spent time in Italy and I've been around a lot of Italians. I'm not Italian. People always think I am, but I wish I were, but no such luck. So I live, you know, vicariously through my characters. And I'm actually writing a book that takes place in Hawaii, which I hope will be, you know, maybe number 5 in the series. It's sort of partially written. And I think the more you travel, the more you meet people, even if you don't apply that exact cultural trait or whatever to your character.
It can
flesh out your characters just by having different personalities. And, you know, the more you meet, I tell authors, the more you can meet people and talk to them and listen to the way they speak, the more alive your writing will become.
I absolutely agree with you 100%. So let's talk about your books. First of all, the first one is called Dying for a Taste, and that is the that's number one in the Sally Soleri mystery series. The one that's out right now is called A Measure of Murder, and the next one is Death al Fresco, and that one releases in March, correct?
That is correct, March 13th from Crooked Lane Books.
And I have to tell you, listeners, that the book covers are just marvelous. They're fun. They're colorful. They're absolutely delicious. And so I hope that you go, because right now you can get Dying for a Taste for under $2 on Amazon. You can go and get your Kindle filled with this lovely book for $1.99 from Leslie Karstz with a K, K-A-R-S-C. And so I hope you do that, because they're fun. The recipes are great. I was thinking, oh, man, I want to make something like this for dinner. Oh, no, I want to make something like that for dinner, because I love to cook, too. I'm not trained at all, but just love it, you know, love to cook. So,
and writing the recipe.
Congratulations
is for fun.
On the success of these. So.
Thank you.
So I think it's magnificent. I know that you're kind of in crisis mode right now, and I don't want to okay. Well, I guess your mother-in-law. I don't want Robin's mom to think
they're
I'm
actually,
stealing
I can
you
hear
away.
Them next door. No, I can hear them next door. They're just talking and chatting, and there's no rush, so don't worry.
Okay. So, well, because I really want to talk about food with you. Because it seems to me that with all the cultural influences in your life, that would also influence your cooking as well, does it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, definitely.
What
you know
is your favorite thing to cook? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'll answer that. I think probably French food because I just love it.
Really?
When I was in cooking school, I became obsessed with sauces because there's so many different kinds of sauces. There are the basic mother sauces, but then there are all the secondary sauces. And once you get a feel for it, you don't really need a recipe anymore, and you can just sort of do it. And that's my favorite thing,
but
sort of messing around in the kitchen.
You're thin. You are thin. How is it that you eat saucy French food and maintain your figure?
I have to work at it, girl. I got kind of chubby in law school when I was eating a lot of top ramen every night and studying. I have to be careful. It's all in moderation. You don't eat a lot, or you just eat a lot once in a while. And also, I'm an obsessive cyclist because basically to keep thin, to keep healthy.
Right. Well, that makes sense.
Where did your love of cooking?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Leslie. Continue.
Well, no, I was just going to answer the question you asked before about the different styles of cooking that come out in the books. And what I was going to say is that in my stories, there are two restaurants. There's Solari's, which is the restaurant run by Sally's father out on the Santa Cruz Wharf. And it's sort of an old school Italian seafood restaurant. And then there's the restaurant that her aunt started called Gauguin, named after Paul Gauguin, the post-impressionist painter. And in the first book, this isn't really giving anything away, because in the first chapter, her aunt Letta is found stabbed to death in her garde-manger, which is the cold food preparation section of the kitchen. And Sally ends up inheriting that restaurant. So she's got these two restaurants in her life. She's got Solari's, the old-fashioned Italian place that she's helping her dad run, and then she's got this restaurant she's just inherited, Gauguin, which is trendy, foodie kind of place. And so what's really great is that when I'm describing them, I get to go to both worlds. I get to describe these really fun, innovative, interesting new recipes, like the kind of thing you might find up at a fancy place in San Francisco. But then I also get to talk about old school, you know, Sunday gravy and tagliatelle and things like that for the other one. And so I can go anywhere with my recipes. I've allowed myself that luxury, and that was on purpose.
You know, it was interesting. Yesterday on NPR, that Anthony Bourdain was on, and he was talking about how when he trained as a chef, he was trained to use every part of whatever fruit, vegetable, or meat or fish that he was preparing. That you never threw anything away. And and they were talking about food waste and everything, and he was saying that particularly what in rural communities, poor people learn to cook like that, like Italian, like you were saying, the Sunday sauce for the Italians, you know, the gravy, and that so many amazing foods came out of the non-availability
the
inability.
Nose to tail idea, you eat every part of the pig. The tradition may come out of the poor community. However, it's absolutely true in all restaurants, because the margin of profit for a restaurant is so minuscule. Because one of the things I've learned about researching the book, but also in cooking school, because we had to take food costing courses, and is you use every single piece of everything. If you're going to do broccoli florets, you need to use the stems in a soup. If you're going to have duck, you need to use the back and make a stock and do something with that. And actually, interestingly, in the book that just came out, A Measure of Murder, there is actually a part in that where they discuss that, and it actually comes up in the story about food costing and how difficult it is. So, yeah, absolutely true.
And I'm that way as a home cook as well. Yeah, he said, you know, a lot of things that are trendy now would have been considered a poor man's meal, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
In the beginning of last century, or after the war or something. And so, and it's really funny, because I took a picture kind of as a joke to send to my friend, who is a retired chef, of chicken feet in the grocery store. And he said, oh, yeah, we used to cook with those all the time. And I went, really? It was just so funny to me, because I wouldn't know what to do with
them.
Really?
Well, you use them in stocks because they're full of gelatin. And so they make a very voluptuous stock to be used as a base,
like
either for soup
almost.
Or for sauces. Yeah, and it has, and when you have that much gelatin in your stock, you know it, when you chill the stock in the refrigerator, it becomes like Jell-O. And when you heat it up, it has this luscious mouthfeel, and that's what the feet are for. And that's one of the things.
Interesting.
You can also just eat them. You know, if you have dim sum at a Chinese place, they often have chicken's feet, and they're actually quite tasty.
It's interesting. So what is your favorite meal to cook in the French cuisine? You said you like doing all the sauces, but you must have a favorite that you love to cook.
Oh, boy. You know, I don't know that I do. I mean, it depends on if I want to do something easy or complicated. For something easy, I probably just would. Easy would be you have a nice piece of meat, a pork chop or a steak or something. You pan fry it while it's resting. You deglaze the pan with brandy and butter and maybe add a little flavorings and drizzle it over your steak, and you know have some roasted potatoes and maybe some, I don't know, sautéed broccoli, which I love, or something like that. That's a really easy meal. You can make the whole thing in about 15-20 minutes. Or you can, you know, do something that takes, you know, a long time. Like Julia Child's recipe for coq au vin is like 6 pages long in her book, because
was
you
it?
Do everything separately. But it's
right.
so good. It's so worth it. You know, you do the mushrooms
yes.
separately and the onions separately, and then you add it all together at the end, and then you really taste each ingredient. Whereas instead of just dumping it all in and making one stew, which is the easy
one
way
stew,
to do
right.
it, but it really does. Some I did that.
I'm
I was
sure it does.
Amazed at how amazing, great it was. But it's very labor intensive. It's not none of it. Generally, cooking isn't difficult in that you have to have a lot of talent or anything, but it can be very laborious and time consuming.
Yes, yes, it can be. Yes, I know. I attempted a 15-layer crepe madeleine, you know, 15 layers of crepe with the whipped cream and the mascarpone and everything. Oh, my goodness gracious.
Ooh.
Had to make the crepes way ahead of time. And you know not every crepe turns when you're making them by hand and you don't have a machine or anything like that. You know, not everyone turns out perfectly. So, and you had to have like, it's actually 18 layers, but, you know, considering the bottom and the top. But you have to have 18 perfect crepes that are going to look good. So I understand. It is, but sometimes there's something very zen about cooking when no one is around or creating, you know,
oh, yes.
something
it's very,
so
I find
wonderful.
It's very relaxing. No,
yes,
I
do too.
Myself in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You
yeah,
have, I mean,
I
and
do
if,
too.
You don't, if you don't feel that way, it's sort of silly to do these long, laborious recipes, so you know, because it's easy enough to do things that are quick. But you know, if you like it, it's a wonderful way to relax. And you know, I love
it. Really
you know,
is
writing for the day, and I'll go into the kitchen and I'll pour myself a glass of wine, and you know, in the early evening, and cook something, and it's great. You know, put some Ella Fitzgerald, and it's.
Oh, there you go.
I can't think of anything I like better.
Oh, there you go. We're sisters from another mister, I'm telling you. I feel exactly the same way. Jeez. Well, we are past our allotted time.
Someday.
We have to. Absolutely. You can invite me to Hawaii or California whenever you want.
Okay, likewise.
And I shall
And I
go.
Love Florida.
Absolutely. And you can, you know, I'm real close to Sanibel. I was just out there yesterday. So you absolutely must come for sure. There's plenty of room in
All
the
right.
new place.
It's a date.
I want to thank you for being with me today on this show, especially in spite of the fact that you're moving mom-in-law. And I'm, you know, going to say a good thought for her and everybody else out there in California that everybody stays safe. I'm glad you're far away
Me
from
too.
It, and I'm glad you're going to be further away without, you know, in Hawaii. You know, I'm not going to be brokenhearted for you, by the way, sister, okay? but let's do this. I want you to come back when the new book comes out, but in the meantime, think of somebody you'd like to interview and come sit behind the microphone with me sometime. We'll
that
have a good time.
Really fun.
It'll be an in-conversation interview. I'll just be your tech, and I'll sit back and enjoy. How's that?
That sounds terrific. Well,
thank
you
so
much,
Leslie Carr, for
me.
Being with me today. It's been a pleasure, and I'm sure I'll be talking to you soon anyway. We'll be swapping recipes
right.
or something, right? Okay.
Absolutely.
Be
All
safe.
Right. Thanks so much. All right. Take care.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening today, folks. I'm so glad you were with me. Stay tuned for more shows. Have a great day, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Bye.